Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review Revisionist History Magazine, a bi-monthly politically incorrect print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. For those interested, we are offering a free sample PDF of the March-April issue and a sample print issue of the Barnes Review. But if you want to fully subscribe to our magazine, visit our website, barnesreview.com. The website is your one-stop shop for revisionist history, which boasts a selection of over 400 revisionist history books. To take advantage of any of these offers, visit barnesreview.com, email sales@barnesreview.org, or call toll-free 1-877-773-9077, Monday to Thursday, 8 to 4 Eastern Time. To get your sample print issue of the Barnes Review, send a $5 postage to the Barnes Review at P.O. Box 550, White Plains, Maryland, 20695. Welcome back to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. And today I have the pleasure of being joined by the great Dr. Kevin McDonald. How are you today?
Pretty good. Kind of cold out yet.
Oh, interesting, interesting. It's already like well into springtime here and down in Texas, but that's to be expected. Well, most of the audience at the Barnes Review is familiar with your work in the Culture of Critique series that details how Jews and organized Jewry came to prominence in Western societies and have dominated the political landscape, Western polities, for the past century or so, give or take. But for today, I wanted to talk about your most recent work, which is actually self-published, that's titled Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition. What prompted you to delve into this topic specifically?
Well, the basic thing is that it's not all about the Jews. I mean, it's partly us. What is it about us that has allowed them to basically take over and to be so influential, I should say, and to promote things like massive immigration, to make white people guilty about their past? They of course, they are impermeable to any self-guilt about their past. Anti-Semitism is always about what other people do and that sort of thing. And so that was the basic thing, but I started getting into it really back in the 1980s. I was a child developmental psychologist, and I studied the family because families have not always been the same. And I was very interested in how things changed over time in Western Europe and other places. And I wrote a few papers then back in the 1980s about that. And the chapter 4 in my book, Individualism, I think is sort of a pivotal chapter because it really shows the uniqueness of family structure in the West and how it's been. You talk about the influence of the church on family structure in the West, but mainly I trace it to before the church, to our basic Western European individualist tendencies that we really originated in prehistoric era, the Indo-Europeans and the Scandinavian hunter-gatherers, I think, are the two pivotal groups. There's another group, the farmers from Asia Minor, but I don't think they figure very strongly in European history, European cultural history. They're sort of different in interesting ways. But the contrast between those groups is really what makes chapter four important. I've never seen anybody else really deal with that. The fact that the Indo-Europeans were so successful in Western Europe, and their family structure, though, really was quite individualistic. And certainly that's the case with the Scandinavian hunter-gatherers. They were the most individualistic people on Earth, surprisingly, in a way. And one of the big paradoxes is, why are Scandinavians so conformist? Why are they so knuckled under to this this culture of hating on white people and everything? But that's an interesting aspect of that chapter. So anyway, that's really how I got into it. Then I got into the Puritans, and I got into the anti-slavery movement in the UK. Very important, because white people are the only people that ever freed the slaves and abolished the slave trade and everything else. So that's one part of the uniqueness of Western civilization. So we should realize we are unique in all the cultures of the world. And I was very happy to see Joseph Henrich's book. He published in 2020. I did mine in 2019. But it's called the Weirdest People in the World, and you capitalize weird, which means Western individualistic, and it's an acronym for Western peoples, and because we are unique, and he goes through all the other cultures of the world, and basically say what I was saying, that these other cultures are fundamentally based on extensive kinship relationships, that they can't get over that. And that's why there's so much corruption in the third world. If you get a good job in the city of Africa or someplace, your first obligation is to help your relatives. They have a very different ethics. Individualistic ethics is you just appraise the act. Is it good or bad? Does it hurt someone? That's not how they think. They think, is it going to help my family? Is it going to help me? They have a different calculus, So individualistic societies are the most moral societies in the world, in a way. It's a sort of unique Western moral tradition that comes from individualism. And so it certainly reverberates in the contemporary world. And the problem that we have now is that Jewish people basically got a hold of our media back in the early 20th century. And they kept spreading these memes about white people bad and Jews are paragons of virtue and all that. And white people, because of the way human psychology works, is that, even though your brainstem, the things that are lower in your brain, I should say, are still sort of healthy. They have, they are somewhat tribal and they are somewhat ethnocentric. They are concerned about outsiders and so on. But the higher parts of your brain can inhibit that. And it's higher parts of the brain, language, what we see on TV, reading books, and get taught in school, that's what really makes a difference. And so that higher part of the brain is programmed by our media and by our educational system. And it has made us into the sort of disaster that we see around us now. So my view is that individualism has been co-opted, it's been exploited, and that our individualist tendencies are what made us so successful in the first place. Mm. But it's being corrupted. It's been corrupted. And we can only hope that we will get more tribal and more collectivist as time goes on. Judaism is a paradigm of a collectivist religion. A collectivist culture, very much preserved with kinship, but their group kinship, but also very concerned about the group in general. So part of one of my earlier books on Judaism was about how There's a sort of tribal ethics there, you know, that the Jews regulated people. They regulated Jews within their own group to maximize group interest, not individual interest. So it was very much a collectivist culture, and contrasts strongly with Western individualist culture. And they've been able to exploit that.
In this context, how would you define individualism?
Individualism, I think, is best thought of in contrast to collectivism. Individualists the family structure of the West is very, very unique, we don't privilege extensive kinships. I don't know who my fourth cousin once removed is, but if you're in a kinship culture, you know all that stuff. And individualists are concerned about their own interest, that of their immediate family, not their wider kinship so much. And the relationships tend to be based on reciprocity rather than, you know, and reputation is very important for individualism. Individual societies evaluate people. Are they honest? Someone I can work with? Can I trust them? Whereas kinship cultures tend to operate on the basis of, you know, how closely related are they to me? What can he do for me, kind of thing. And so it's a very different perspective. I don't know exactly how I define individualism apart from that. I mean, you have to think about it has all these ramifications, you know, in terms of ethics and how you evaluate people and so on. And, you know, this is really why the West triumphed, because we had, you know, our cultures tended to be based on reciprocity and fairness. And lack of corruption. You could, people in public office, you could trust much more than still. That's the problem that Africa has. You can keep pouring money into Africa all you want, but it's never going to really change things. And there'll always be massive corruption. And these sort of warring kinship groups and so on that we see, you know, the British drew all these borders around the world, but they didn't really correspond to kinship borders. And so that now you have African countries that are rife with kinship conflict, which is not something you've seen in Western countries. We have basically gotten beyond that. And it occurs, you know, and especially, you know, Western Europe is different from Eastern Europe. Kinship is more important in Eastern Europe, and that, I think, is saving them to some extent now. That plus the fact that they lived through communism and realize that, you know, they don't want this liberal leech is sort of putting them into a police state. So anyway, there's a big contrast between individualist cultures and the cultures of the rest of the world. We should take pride in that at the same time, realize its limitations and realize we have to get over individualism, at least briefly, to get out of this problem that we have right now where, you know, people, in immigration, you know, Westerners say, is it bad for me? Is it bad for my business? They don't think of the big picture that white people in general are being swamped and that will be a minority and what will happen in the future. They don't think so much about the future. The future will take care of itself kind of thing, but it won't. And so we have to really take account of group interests, like Jews always have. And it's much more adaptive. I mean, if you have a battle between an individualist culture, subculture in our society, and a collectivist culture, the collectivist culture is going to win out because they're on board with the broader interests of their group, and they have group discipline. You think about Jewish groups. I mean, they're incredibly organized, incredibly cohesive. And they are able to, you know, they in the academic world, they cite one another, they promote one another. In the business world, it's the same kind of thing. And of course, they have these self-defense organizations that pathologize European identity and all that. But it's very well financed because they're a wealthy group. And that's another source of their power.
In terms of white European civilizations, I do agree that when you look at it on a relative basis, when you compare, say, like Western societies to those of the Orient, that there is a clear individualist versus collectivist dichotomy. But even among Western Europeans, I mean, just Europeans in general, you do see some schisms, and you did mention like Eastern Europe, but I'd also look at the case of Southern Europeans, like Mediterraneans. You do see certain kinship structures there that are a bit more communal and slightly more nepotistic. Is there like a clear Nordic versus like Mediterranean divide when you look at like the levels of individualism that are expressed among Western countries?
Yes, for sure. And one of the points I make in the first chapter, I talk about population genetics, is that there's a north-south climb in genetics. The further south you go and the east you go, the more collectivist. And especially in the chapter four, in the family, I contrast France, northeastern France, which is, you know, colonized by the Indo-Europeans, versus South France, they're very different. They're very collectivist. Land is owned by families. Brothers live together, and all that. That's typically what you see often in Eastern Europe, but you don't see it in Western Europe. I don't think it's paradigmatic of Western Europe. But in the same in Italy. You go to the further south you go in Italy, the more clan-like, the more familial it is. I've seen like the mafia, which is really foreign to Northern European culture. But we're seeing it now. You know, Sweden's full of gangs now because they've been periods. That's what you get. They've got to wake up and realize these peoples are different. And they're not going to change overnight. They're not going to assimilate and suddenly be good Swedes. It's just not going to happen. But yeah, I make a big deal of the climb between Northern and Southern Europe. But Northern Italy, for example, is not collectivist and is much more individualistic, much more culturally. You know, they used to keep talking about the Renaissance very much a part of Western culture. But the further south you go, the less that is the case. And there is a genetic divide there with the northern Italians being more like continental Europe and southern Italians not so much. And you see, you know, economically, where's the power in Italy? It's in the north, Milan and all that. It's not in southern Italy. Full of corruption.
You mentioned a point about how with the influx of Jewish migration, especially to the United States, and the establishment of like an organized Jewish community, that they were able to exploit the individualistic proclivities of Westerners. And what ways were the Jewish individuals and organizations able to do so?
Well, I the main thing I think was, I'm just revising my book, Culture of Critique. And one of the big points I make, this is based on Andrew Joyce's work, talking about after World War II, you had this Jewish group, which was affiliated to some extent with the Frankfurt School, and they then branched out into the academic world in the area of public relations and sort of media influence. And so they studied this. And you know, unlike so much of the culture critique, this was good science because they were really trying to figure out, how do you influence people? And again, it takes advantage of the fact that the human brain is able to control, the higher parts of the brain are able to control the more evolutionarily ancient parts of the brain, which are, you know, more ethnocentric, more prone to in-group favoritism and all that. So they really had a big research program, and they got that involved with the TV networks back, you know, after World War II and even before. All the big networks were owned by Jews, CBS, ABC, and NBC. When I was growing up, those were the only networks, and they were all owned by Jews. And then you had the Hollywood studios, also owned by Jews. And so those were huge sources of Jewish influence at that time. Now, I recently wrote an article saying I think this may be declining now because of the rise of the internet and the decline of the legacy media. You don't have that kind of monopoly anymore of these completely Jewish-owned networks staffed with Jews who are, you know, schooled in mass media influence and that sort of thing. And now you've got the rise of people like Joe Rogan, Tucker Carlson, the podcasts, and you know, the alternative media in general, like, you know, my website and many others, in American Renaissance. And so there's a lot of the three big sources of Jewish power have been, first of all, the media. And I think that is what's declining quite a bit now. You see these studies of media influence and so on, things like the New York Times. If you read the New York Times, which I do, before the election, it was just, you know, they have 10 hate Trump articles every day. And they still do. But they didn't sway the election. And of course, they do have a clientele, but they, you know, it's not as powerful as it once was. And the other source is the academic world, which is really the main topic of culture of critique, where you have especially the top institutions, you know, Harvard, Yale, the Ivy League, University of California, the Big Ten University. These are dominated at the top by the left. And that was, the Jews were instrumental in that. I wrote a paper on the rise of the Jews in the academic world. And it was really the rise of the left, because the Jewish community, especially back saying, well, even now, is still well to the left of the American average. Jews still, even, you know, in the last election, there's about 70-some percent Jews voted for Kamala Harris instead of Trump. And back in the 1930s, there was a huge influence of communism. Mainstream Jewish organizations were affiliated with communist front groups and that sort of thing. And that got kind of purged in the 1950s with the McCarthyism and all that. But the academic world, especially in the 1960s, and I sort of experienced this firsthand as a student at the University of Wisconsin. I was in the philosophy department, and you could see this turnover from the old faculty, which was not Jewish, probably at all, really, to a new faculty, which was almost all Jewish. They were on the left, as a Jewish community was in general. And, you know, so they really started dominating the academic world, and so many of them. And the academic world is a top-down kind of thing, you know. It starts out with Harvard and those kind of universities, and it filters down. What you have now is a system that rigorously polices hiring. And you're not going to get a job. In fact, until the Trump administration, all these universities had you had to have diversity statements in order to get hired. Yeah, you had to have diversity statements. What, and not only what you believe, how wonderful diversity is, but you have to say what you have done personally to advance the cause of diversity. It's just oppressive as hell. But anyway, the Trump administration has sort of really gone after that, which is, you know, to their credit. But the left took over the universities. I think basically in the 1960s, I showed the rise in percentage of Jewish professors, and especially at elite universities. And Jewish professors were, you know, publishing more and everything else. They became the elite academics, and it has had a huge influence down to the kindergarten. And the third source of Jewish influence is simply Jewish wealth, because Jewish organizations are incredibly well-funded. And so all these organizations, whether it's the ADL or the Israel Lobby, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, all these things are very well-funded, and that's a big source of their influence. The Southern Poverty Law Center is not officially Jewish, but their Jewish money has always been critical to their success. And but I think now what's happening is that the media influence is declining. And then you have the rise of people like Elon Musk, who really, first of all, he's not Jewish, and he's extremely wealthy. And I think he had a very important part in the 2024 election. And, if you've got many, many billions like that, he's lost a lot of money because of his campaign against Tesla, but he's still very rich. And, the whole campaign cost less than $1 billion. So he could easily afford that. And so I think what we're seeing now is the possible rise of a non-Jewish elite. And I'm really looking forward to that. The alternative media and a non-Jewish elite that is well-financed, able to fund these elections. That is what I think could really change America. That's what I'm putting my hope in, because I think Trump, to some extent, gets it, but he sure is addicted to Israel and Israel's interests in a way that I don't think will be necessary. If you get this non-Jewish elite in there, you could have all of the ADL and all this Israel lobby and everything else, but they'll be much less effective if there's a lot of countervailing money out there. Our democracy runs on money, let's face it. And people with big money like that have a huge outsized influence that people like me and you don't. That's the problem. But that is sort of taking care of itself. Elon Musk has made some incredible statements about Jews and about, he's a South African. I think he gets it about race. He does not want America to become a non-white. And he's made some statements about Jews, that they hated white people and all that. Now, he apologized, but, anybody can apologize. The amazing thing is that he said it on a social media where he had 100-some million followers. So he's an important guy. Elon Musk, I think, is critical.
So when you were an academic, was historical revisionism largely suppressed, or was it tolerated in certain, like, universities or in certain niche topics?
It was pretty suppressed when I was through the entire time, very much. And I had a sort of gradual conversion to all this stuff. I didn't really start to be a critic of Jewry until I had read a lot. And I got this idea. I'm writing a book about a collectivist culture like Judaism and how they had managed to stay together for 2,000 plus years. And that made me read about the history of Judaism. And being an evolutionist, I didn't believe that it was all the problem of the Gentiles that they were living among. Anti-Semitism. And so it was very gradual. I mean, I voted for Reagan. I thought Reagan was going to solve all the problems of America. And it wasn't until about 1991 or so that I got into this Jewish thing. I'd already written about the ancient Greek Spartans as an example of a collectivist culture that was very successful for a while. But Well, once I got into Judaism, I realized this is incredibly important. These people have had extraordinary influence, and they're smart, and they've been able to harness that smart, the intelligence and everything. So anyway, it's changed my life to really get into it. And historical, the Holocaust revisionism was just beyond the pale when I was an academic. I would never have thought about doing that. But after I got into the Jewish thing, I people contacted me because you say 1998, especially when my book Culture Creep came out, people contacted me, including Holocaust revisionists, and I would talk to them and. But I'm not an expert on Holocaust. I don't really know. It's not something I've spent time on. How many gas chambers? How many dead? How fast can they be incinerated? All those things. It's just foreign to me, and it's not something I care to know about. I'm happy to say it happened. But it's also certainly a weapon that the Jewry has used to advance their interests. Israel, the Holocaust narrative is a big support for the country of Israel. And they continue to invoke it anytime there's a rise in anti-Jewish sentiment. They will invoke the Holocaust. And it's something. Again, if you look at how it operates, you have these wealthy Jewish organizations pressuring state legislatures to get Holocaust Jewish study courses in universities and Holocaust stuff in the education system from kindergarten through 12th grade. So it's a full court press. And that's how you have to think of Jewish activism. It's a full court press. It's going to get you from all ways. It's going to be well funded. It's going to be in the elite media. It's going to be top down all the way. They're going to recruit prominent Gentiles, as they always have. I mean, if you're a small minority, what choice do you have? You have to recruit people from the majority culture. And they've been doing that since in the late 19th century at the latest. They've recruited all kinds of spokesmen for pro-immigration spokesmen, people who there's a big dispute with Russia. The Jews hated the Tsar. That culminated in the Bolshevik Revolution. But there was a bill in the United States they had a treaty with Russia, a trade treaty. This is 1910 in the Taft administration. And they recruited all these prominent Gentiles to come out against that bill. And eventually, their position won out. And Russia was, there's hatred, Jewish hatred for Russia. And I still think that's there. And I do think that is behind so much of what's going on with the neoconservatives and how they hate Russia. And this is part of what's going on with the Ukraine war, of course. So there's no people that hate like the Jews, and they really hate Russia because of what they perceive as this historical anti-Semitism there. And the fact that they got booted out, basically, after being so dominant in the early decades of the Soviet Union, they were basically demoted, shall we say, and a lot of them left the Soviet Union because they were persecuting Jews, in quotes. And they weren't really persecuted. They were still overrepresented in the elite, but they really had control of Jews by that time. And they were not a Jewish power. So you had these neoconservatives in the United States going after the Soviet Union, mainly really because of how they treated the Jews. And that's one of the big reasons. Of course, they toppled the Soviet Union. And at that point, they decided, one world power, let's take advantage of it. And they have, yes.
The point you raise about Russia, I believe, is quite germane because it does seem that we are experiencing a paradigm shift on the global stage with great powers such as Russia and even China flexing their muscles on the world stage in recent years. And do you get the impression of these changing international like relations and like the dynamics and these relations that the world is that the post World War II order is crumbling?
It is crumbling, and I think Trump, you had this globalist ideology, which was really being promulgated everywhere from elite institutions throughout the West. And, you know, I'm a critic of Trump like everybody is, but I do think that he's got his head in the right place when it comes to globalism. And he wants, American national interests come first. And Europe has been dependent, ridiculously dependent on the United States. And they can't go on. They have to stand up and defend themselves. And I think we're entering a multipolar world, which is in some ways dangerous, I suppose. But at the same time, it's inevitable. The Chinese are very smart people. They're hugely populated country. They're really productive, and they deserve a place in the world power structure. And I'm going to have to deal with that. But we're in Russia. Is Russia? They are not as productive economically, but they have huge natural resources. And they're going to be a power. And they have this military tradition. And they're a tough people. So I'm hopeful. I mean, when the Ukraine war broke out, I wrote things very much in favor of Russia winning this war, because my feeling is that if Ukraine wins, there's going to be another aspect of this globalism, and they're going to you'll see the destruction of Ukraine via immigration and all that. You already see articles saying that we need millions of immigrants in Ukraine because so many people have left, and so they're going to bring Africa up to Ukraine. I mean, what a disaster. So they have to, have a nationalist government, one that takes care of the Ukrainian people. It acknowledges Russia's interests in the eastern part of Ukraine. That's my view. And we'll see. I'm not sure what Trump, I'm not sure exactly what Putin wants. But, Ukraine not being part of NATO is certainly non-negotiable. I mean, that's what the war was all about, really. And that's viewed as Russian propaganda by the Western media, but that is the reality. And so we'll see what happens. But I don't think Putin's just going to give in and say, "Oh, ceasefire." He has that demand about NATO, and he has demands, I think, about Eastern Ukraine that it be Russian. I mean, the whole thing was ridiculous. I mean, it was just a partitioning of a country that they drew up the borders administratively and so on. It wasn't really based on ethnic language considerations. So we'll see. I don't know.
In terms of other geopolitical events, the October 7th attacks against Israel, it seems this one is particularly salient because I have noticed much more anti-Semitic and even, well, at least Judeo-skeptic sentiments disseminated across social media. And this is on a transpartisan basis, not just like on the left or the right. It's all across the board. Do you believe that this change in the perception of Israel and even broader Jewry will sow the seeds for a revival in like historical revisionism about World War II, the Holocaust, and even start questioning organized Jewry's motives altogether?
I would certainly hope that, and I think there is a very strong possibility of that. I mean, you see people like Tucker Carlson inviting Beryl Cooper on and really saying some things about Churchill and taking, what was the German point of view on all this? And that just hasn't been out there. And Jewish organizations are furious. But yeah, Israel's actions in Gaza and the West Bank, and now they're expanding into part of Syria and Lebanon. Who can say, have this image of Jews as these paragons of morality and all that? I mean, they're bombing the crap out of Gaza now. And they're still killing lots and lots of people. So, yeah, people on the left really are. Yeah, I say honest leftists are horrified by what's going on. But people on the right, who had their heads, unfortunately, so many, if you look at conservative media, I watch Newsmax now, and I got it. When it comes to Israel, they are absolutely hopeless. But I'm seeing that a lot of people on the right really get it, that Israel is not, some kind of moral paragon. They are expansionary, and you have the rise of the ethno-nationalists right over there. And it's interesting that Netanyahu is making alliances with the right in Europe, which is pro-Israel. And I do think that the right is in Europe and America, a lot of their support for, they feel that they can be protected if they support Israel and Jewish interests, because, there's been such a deluge of hatred against the right that this gives them some legitimacy, like Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. But, and a lot of them see Islam as by far the worst enemy that they have. And they may be right about that. But I think it's very important. And I see people on the left going off on Israel. And what else could they possibly do if they had any shred of honesty? I mean, these are people that are all about, kumbaya, love one another. These people, just bombing thousands and killing thousands of women and children and this decimate. I mean, there's not a building standing in Gaza, as far as I can see. It's all, now they have to live in tents. And now they're booting them out of Rafah again. And they're just going to go wall-to-wall bombing, and it's just absolutely out of control. And the world stands by. No other country could get away with that. So Israel still has very powerful friends, but I'm thinking that their power, it's not unlimited. And if we get the rise, if Donald Trump would get his head screwed on right about Israel, I mean, he's got the power now to ignore the Israel lobby. He doesn't have to worry about them. And at some point, the people in this country on the right are going to realize that. They don't need Israel anymore. And, of course, you got these Christian Zionists. But they're not, these people are not culturally that influential. And I do think that you don't have to cow to Israel anymore, that you can win elections without that. And we'll see, though. Right. I think I would like to see that happen, but I don't know.
That's definitely something to watch out for in the next few decades, because I do agree with the point that you brought up earlier that alternative media has created a new vector for the dissemination of ideas that breaks through like the gatekeep, a lot of gatekeeping mechanisms. And now I think that many of these assumptions that we've seen in like the post-World War II order are starting to crumble before our eyes now that they're being scrutinized more. There's just much more information. And also, I wouldn't underestimate as well the abundance of non-English material that's surfacing about organized Jewry, because we have to remember, too, this is a civilization that has lived for like 3,000 years or so. So they've had interactions with Westerners and non-Westerners alike. And I do believe that we may be heading towards a renaissance of this type of material resurfacing again.
Boy, I'd like to see that. And I think it's possible. I'm always remaining optimistic, and I do see how it could happen. I was talking about, you know, the fact we have, you know, non-Jews have enough money, and we have enough. This new media is so critical. And I think especially young people, they don't read the New York Times. They listen to Joe Rogan. And Joe Rogan is really pretty based in a lot of ways. He's a former liberal like everybody else, as Elon Musk was, as I was. I mean, you know, everybody was, because that's the way we were brought up. And that's the way the world was. But, you know, you pretty soon you start seeing through that. And this gender craziness, you know, that really affected him, I think. His son became his daughter, supposedly, and she rejects him completely. So I think that it could happen. And if it doesn't happen, you know, we are absolutely screwed, because, you know, white people are going to be inundated more than we are now. This is why it's so important to do this re-migration thing, as they call it, in Europe. And we have to do the same in this country. And it's difficult. You can see, you know, all the judges, so many judges are on the left, and all these organizations going to bat for the immigrants, because they really want the United States to be a non-white country. Jews are one of our big points in the chapter on immigration and cultural critique, is simply that Jews saw Nazi Germany and all these Jews at the time, you know, they started out as communists, Marxists, and they believe in the working class. Well, they realize the working class ain't necessarily going to be on their side. And the working class voted for Hitler, a lot of them. And that's what they worry about here. What you have was a homogeneous white society that eventually turned on the Jews. Well, their solution was to make it a non-white society, to make it, multi-ethnic, multicultural. And that's what we got, because their power in the academic world, in the media, and funding organizations and all that. So that's what we're with now. And there's very good Jews. If I was a Jew, I'd probably want the same thing. But it's not in our interest, and we have to stop it. And but you can see how hard it is to deport people. They're saying that Trump's managed to deport 100,000 people. Well, that's nice, I suppose. But at the same time, you know, you got the congressman calling for the repatriation of these gangbangers, which he acknowledged were gangbangers. In El Salvador, they're on their prison there. It's like craziness. But it's in Jamie Raskin's interest as a Jewish congressman from Maryland or wherever, but it's not in my interest. But even 100,000 is just a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, it's a drop in the bucket. That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah.
Really, it's nothing. A lot of people think like 15 million came in under Biden. Well, you're a long ways from 1 million.
Yeah.
So, it's a huge uphill struggle just to get rid of illegals. And then you got, you know, generations of people that have become citizens and are now interwoven into the power structure and beneficiaries of DEI and everything. So it's like it's a long road back. OK, and we'll see. But you can see how it could turn around.
Yeah, but it's uphill struggle for sure. But I'm optimistic because thanks to the internet and more people becoming aware of these ideas. And also the work that you've done in decades prior has inspired countless people like myself to delve into these topics and continue to spread this message. But I think this is a great place to draw this talk to a close, Dr. McDonald. And before we leave, could you let the audience know where they can follow your latest works?
Yeah, you know, I maintain a blog site, doctrinalobserver.net. And I have a personal website, kevinmacdonald.net, where you can see where my books and how to order them. Again, I'm revising the culture of critique, and the schedule, we're trying to get it out by before May 1st, because I've only got one more chapter to turn into them, and I'm going to make a few changes in that. And it's a lot longer. It's more, the first one was a tome, but now this one's going to be worse. And I do worry it's too long, but at the same time, yeah, this is sort of my complete statement about it, and it probably won't be anymore. I'm 81 years old, and please subscribe to the Occidental Quarterly, which I edit. Occidental Quarterly is sort of longer academic focused articles. It's very important that we have that. I mean, that's one thing that Jews have always had. I mean, well, I was just reading my chapter on the New York intellectuals, and they had magazines like Partisan Review and Dissent and all of that. And they were well subscribed. The Jews would subscribe to it, other people on the left. And they became culturally important. Commentary, which was published by the American Jewish Committee. And, you know, that is an important magazine. A lot of people who are not Jews read it. So we got to do that. And, you know, so we have to support our media, support guys like you, you know, very, very important to do that. And see how you can make a difference, whether it's contributing money to people, whether it's blogging, writing, organizing, whatever. You know, there are a lot of ways to do it. But everybody's got to wonder, ask themselves, what can I do? Because we are in a very desperate situation, despite the optimism that I and you have, which is justified. I think that, you know, we've been through difficult times before. It takes political will and to really do it. And you know, what if we said, okay, all this, the people whose ancestors became citizens after, as a result of the 1965 immigration law, I'm sorry, we're revoking all that. You have to go somewhere else. You know, that's tough. It's extremely tough. It would ruin people's lives. But at the same time, what are we going to do? Just let it happen where we are swamped, where we become a persecuted minority, which is what would happen. I mean, there's so much anti-white hate out there. And, you know, it's become mainstreamed. You see people like Joy Reid on MSNBC, who got fired, but at the same time, I hear she's got a podcast or Substack, I think. And, you know, it's like we have to stand up and do this and do it quickly because we are in very bad shape.
All right, Dr. Macdonald, thank you so much for your time. And also to the audience, thank you again for tuning in. For the Barnes Review History Hour, this is Jose Nino signing out.